From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted this morning that minutes before the U.S. was going to strike military sites in Iran last night, he called off the attack. He said he scuttled the mission because he said it wasn't proportionate to Iran's shooting down a U.S. drone earlier this week. Nobody was killed in the drone attack. The president says he was told some 150 people could die if the U.S. went through with its strike.
So let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Ayesha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
And Chad Pergram, senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start there. There was some unusual language in the president's tweets this morning. He said we were cocked and loaded to retaliate against Iran. Ayesha, what does the White House do now?
Well, right now, they're not saying much about what comes next. But President Trump did mention sanctions being added last night. So we're trying to get more information on what exactly that may mean. And from the tweets that President Trump put out, it seems like for now that there has been a decision made that they're not going to do strikes because it's not proportional to what happened with the drone. And so that seems to be off the table for now. What will happen later, we're not sure.
Okay, well, let's listen to what some members of Congress have been saying. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham urged President Trump to follow in Ronald Reagan's footsteps and order strikes on Iran as Reagan did in 1987.
If they do anything else against an American asset, and this president doesn't respond like Ronald Reagan, then that's the signal to North Korea and the entire world we're all talk.
And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke after meeting with the president about this at the White House yesterday.
One of the best ways to avoid bumbling into war, a war that nobody wants, is to have a robust, open debate and for Congress to have a real say.
Chad, where is Congress on what next?
Well, what Senator Schumer is referring to here is an AUMF, Authorization for the Use of Military Force. We passed one in 2001 after 9/11 to go into Afghanistan. It's been used, some people think, too broadly for operations in Georgia, the Philippines, Yemen. We passed another AUMF in late 2002 for the war in Iraq in 2003. And those calcified AUMFs are still out there, and they say that, if we're going to go to war, they need to have a new one. That's something that both Schumer and the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi were advocating. Now, here's the problem that the president might start to run into. Fox just spoke before we came on the air here with Adam Kinzinger. He's a Republican congressman from Illinois. He has a military background. And he said, quote, am I disappointed in the president's decision? Yes. He said there needs to be a reaction. If there's not a reaction, that's a bad move. And he says that if the president continues to rattle sabers, that could, in fact, call into question his credibility here. We also spoke with Adam Smith. He is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Democrat from Washington State. He was part of that briefing in the Situation Room yesterday with the president and his advisors. And Adam Smith told me just a few minutes ago that it was obvious that the president was struggling with this decision. And he wished that the president wouldn't kind of use that, as you say, strange language here, airing the suggestion about casualties. Adam Smith says he wishes the president would have been more discreet his term.
Ayesha, I wonder if you can tell us what's happening today on Capitol Hill and who the president seems to be listening to. Because as you heard Chuck Schumer say, one of the best ways to avoid bumbling into a war that nobody wants, is to have an open debate. To what extent is there an open debate at all and any kind of safeguards toward bumbling into a war or conflict with Iran?
I think, as with most things, getting Congress on the same page to actually pass something like an AUMF, a new AUMF would be a very tall order.
This is the authorization.
So you're likely to hear a lot of talking about this and maybe some complaints from Democrats. But what actually Congress will do, it seems like it's going to be very hard to get everybody on the same page. And what's interesting is you do have kind of these two sides saying, okay, the U.S. needs to show its strength and the U.S. needs to back up kind of all of this tough talk that President Trump does. And then you have others saying, look, we don't want to kind of bumble into a war. And I think that's really what President Trump is kind of struggling with. He likes to be tough, but he also wants to avoid a major military conflict. And that's kind of what he campaigned on. And so that's something that he wants to not happen. And I think that he feels like if he gets bogged down in a war, that would be something that he did not campaign on.
So, and this is what it comes back to about to Aisha's point here, which is very good, about members of Congress struggling with this AUMF. What is war? Do you engage with their Navy? Do you engage with their military? Do you hit their defense capabilities on the ground somewhere? Is that an offensive strike? And this is where people start to say on Capitol Hill, well, it says in Article 1 that the Congress has the power to declare war, but we've been using, you know, these authorizations that are very old, which are not specific to this, and are we, in fact, in line with the Constitution? And getting the votes to approve a new AUMF is very challenging.
So when it comes to playing out the consequences of a strike like that, and supposedly we were within 10 minutes of a strike, according to the president, before he canceled it, who's talking to the president about that? There is no permanent Secretary of Defense right now. Who is guiding him?
Well, he does have his national security advisor, John Bolton, and you have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and others, the head of the CIA. So you have these advisors, and they are saying that the White House is saying that these advisors were united in their support for the military action, in their support for the strike before the president made the final decision to pull back. So that is their argument. They're saying they're united. But we do know that some of his advisors are more hawkish and may want to take a more offensive strategy when it comes to Iran.
I want to ask about a couple of other issues in the news this week. Roy Moore, the former Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice who lost that Senate race last time around to Democrat Doug Jones, has said he will run again. President Trump doesn't want him to do that, but he says he will run for the Senate seat. After the accusations of sexual misconduct with teenagers decades ago came up. Here's Roy Moore.
I'm not going against President Trump at all. I support President Trump. I'll vote for President Trump. Whether he votes for me or not, we'll see.
Chad, what's at stake in this race?
Well, this is a seat that ought to be in the Republican column. It's held now by a Democrat, Doug Jones. There's a reason that he holds that seat. It's because he ran against Roy Moore. There has been some chatter that Republicans might try to get Jeff Sessions, the former senator who, you know, left that seat. There's a reason why there was a vacancy there and why there was a special election.
But he's not very close with President Trump either, right?
Well, that's right. But Jeff Sessions served, for a long time, dating back to 1996 as senator from Alabama. The question is, would Jeff Sessions be perceived as maybe tainted now, as maybe being either too on board with the Trump administration or not enough, because he was kind of at odds at President Trump there. But there are other candidates there. But this, frankly, was good news for Democrats. They would love nothing more to run against Roy Moore, and it gives them a really good shot to hold that seat.
Okay, and we've got this debate coming up, two debate nights coming up next week for the Democrats who are running for president. And on MSNBC last night, Cory Booker, one of the presidential candidates, said he and Joe Biden spoke on the phone about Biden's remarks at a fundraiser this week, praising his work with pro-segregation senators in the 1970s. To get things done in Washington. Booker says he still wants an apology.
He said things that are hurtful and are harmful. I believe he should be apologizing to the American people and having this discussion with all of us, and that there is actually an opportunity here now for someone who is a former vice president, is someone who's seeking to be the leader of the party and the nation, for him to speak to these issues.
Aisha, going into a big political weekend in South Carolina, what should Biden say to black voters there?
I think Biden is going to have to make his case and kind of try to get past all of these comments that are kind of going back to the past and try to make the case for why he's the candidate of the future and why he's the candidate of today. So I think he's going to. I think it remains to be seen how much he's going to have to answer from the actual black voters for these comments and how whether this will affect their support, which so far has been pretty strong. But he's definitely going to have to his rivals are not letting this go. So they're going to keep bringing it up. So he's going to have an answer for why he kind of made those comments about the segregationists.
Just before the broadcast. I'm sorry.
Trying to bring it forward. Oh, yeah.
Just before the broadcast, John Lewis, the Democratic congressman from Georgia, civil rights icon, we spoke to him from Fox here, and he said, quote, "I don't think the remarks from Joe Biden are offensive." His message to Joe Biden, quote, "keep the faith and keep his eyes on the prize and never, ever give up." And, you know, it's interesting that you have these other Democratic senators who are running for president trying to, you know, force a wedge here with Senator Biden, talking about him working with these segregationist senators. You know, some of those senators have had their offices in the Russell Senate Office Building, named after Senator Richard Russell, who certainly had issues with race. They do interviews from the Russell Rotunda. They attend hearings in the Russell Senate Office Building. And some of those same people who've been criticizing Joe Biden don't have any compunction about the Russell Senate Office Building.
It's also helpful, I think, to note that to the extent Biden is buying into these jabs he's getting from all around, it wasn't that long ago, Aisha, that the issue was Biden's smelling somebody's hair, and we don't hear a lot about that now.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, these issues kind of come and go, and we have a very long campaign season ahead of us.
Aisha Roscoe, you'll be covering it for us, NPR White House reporter, and Chad Pergram, senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
This year, some college and high school graduates have been calling themselves not the class of 2019, but the class of zero. They're calling on politicians to prioritize the climate and get to zero carbon emissions in the next 11 years. More than 350 commencement speakers are delivering the same message in their speeches.
Today, we celebrate our achievements from the last 4 years.
But I want to talk about what we need to achieve in the next 11.
11 years to avoid catastrophic climate change.
Our diplomas may say class of 2019, but marked in history, we are the class of zero.
Zero emissions.
Zero excuses.
And zero time to waste.
In unity, we are giving our leaders a choice. Give us a plan to get to zero emissions.
Or get zero of our votes.
You heard Robin Happel, Sarah Hewitt, and Paul Campion delivering the class of zero message as part of their commencement speeches. Leah Harrell is a youth climate activist and one of the organizers. Leah, what inspired you to start this movement?
We wanted it to be a message that was nonpartisan because climate is not a partisan issue. And we wanted it to be very clear with what our intent was. So the whole message of we demand a plan from our candidates. We want them to get to zero emissions or we're going to give them zero of our votes. That's the thing that we really wanted to hone in with the audience and make them remember that, and that our generation is going to be taking that message with us to the polls.
So how did you go about recruiting valedictorians and class speakers at graduations?
A lot of it was dependent on the current networks that we already have from a lot of organizations. And kind of that was the initial wave. And after that, we asked people to spread it through social media. If there were accepted students, to post it on their Facebook pages. I did a little blurb on Facebook, and I think it encouraged a few people from my college who spoke at their graduations. And slowly it kind of trickled out. And that's really what inspired this, you know, hundreds of students speaking out.
So was it read at your own high school graduation?
No, it was not.
Really? How come?
The administrators didn't think that this was the right moment for these speeches. And I don't want to, you know, throw my high school under the bus or anything or say anything negative about them, but this general sentiment that activism is secondary when talking about all of these important life moments, I think it needs to be right intertwined along with them. And those are the moments in which activism speaks the loudest.
What do you do with the disappointment? You know, when some of the students are told they can't read this thing.
I think what I always try to fall back on is remembering that there's going to be always people who are going to try and get in the way. But the fact that there are people who are pushing against you means that you're doing something meaningful, because you can't create change without some sort of friction. So whenever there's those setbacks, I always remember, what is my long-term vision? I want a better future. We'll get through this together. And that's what needs to happen in order for things to change, if we want any shot at saving our future.
Have you spoken with a lot of students who have been the class speakers and valedictorians and have read the speech?
Yeah, so I follow the Class of Zero on Instagram, and I see all the speakers giving their speeches every few days. One of my good friends on the student leadership team, she read her speech, and it was really exciting to see her speak about it. And, you know, there was applause after every few sentences, and it just felt really gratifying and powerful to hear the words that we read being spoken aloud in all those videos.
How did you become a climate activist?
Well, about 3 years ago, I really began to understand that the climate crisis is not just about our natural spaces, and it's not just about preserving a few things that are endangered. It's really so much more intertwined with my life, with the people around me, with our global community, and it intersects in all of these aspects of our societies, and they have the potential to, when they interact, all these negative impacts, they have the potential to really threaten my future and my happiness, my livelihood, and I never want to be put in that position. So that is really what propelled me into being taking an active role in trying to help to find these solutions so that I can try to make my future a better place for my generation and the next generations.
Leah, is there any event that you can point to that made you realize you wanted to champion the issue of climate change?
I think it was my interactions with all of the other youth activists that really pulled me into this scene. I saw what all of my colleagues were doing at neighboring high schools. They were able to pass amazing policies to make their communities leaders in climate action. I was able to see students protesting against this pipeline that is potentially going to run through my state. And I think just seeing the flame in all of their eyes and the passion that they have is what made me so committed to saying, I want to be able to fight for this and to invest my life and have that same flame in me so that we can achieve these goals together.
Leah Harrell, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Turn to television now. Mainstream television shows don't feature many characters who are Latino or Latina. The gender-neutral term is Latinx. But two very different shows do. ABC's drama Grand Hotel came out Monday. Comedy Central just released a new sketch comedy show, Alternatino, with Arturo Castro. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has watched both these shows. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Let's start with Grand Hotel. It's executive produced by Eva Longoria and based on a popular show from Spain. What can you tell us about the adaptation?
So this is your typical nighttime soap opera, except it's centered on a Latino family who owns a hotel. It's supposed to be the last family-owned hotel on South Beach in Miami. We've got a clip to give you a sense of how crazy some of the storylines are, because it is based on a telenovela. We have the daughter of the hotel owner talking to a guy who manages the hotel staff. And, of course, they both have secrets of their own, and they're trying to figure out what's going on with the father, who has announced that he's decided to sell the hotel. Let's check it out.
Hey, does my dad seem a little off to you?
No, not really. Why?
Selling the hotel? Keeping it a secret? I asked him about the girl who went missing in the hurricane. He got all weird and changed the subject.
I think your dad selling this place has really thrown you for a loop, Alicia. Seriously, your brain is working overtime, trying to figure out what else he's hiding. But the truth is, you just don't like what's happening.
So this is like not on from 1 to 2 in the afternoon. This is actually nighttime programming.
It's actually nighttime. A girl who has a dangerous secret suddenly vanishes in a hurricane. I wonder what happened. Anyway, it's interesting because in the last few years, we've seen these studies that show Hispanics are the most underrepresented group of people on television. While they could be 16 to 17% of the population, often their percentage of characters in primetime television and movies is closer to 4 or 5%. So now they've been trying to create shows that would be great vehicles for Latinx characters. There's a unifying force amongst Spanish language television because of the language unifier that can bring together people who are from Guatemala and people from Cuba and people from Mexico to watch the same show. When you create an English language show, you don't have that unifier. And I think, especially in network television, they haven't figured out how to create a program that really would get a wide-ranging audience in the same way that some of these other shows speaking to black audiences or other ethnicities have done.
What about Comedy Central's Alternatino, built around host Arturo Castro? Let's listen to a moment from the show, which is all about a first date.
So, Arturo.
You don't have to say it like that. It's Arturo, you know?
Arturo.
Okay.
What was it like growing up in Guatemala? I mean, that must have been crazy, yeah?
I don't know about crazy. I lived in the suburbs. We had a little yard with a dog.
Like a sexy Guatemalan street mutt?
A collie. Like Lassie.
So this is a comedy series, and that sketch that we heard is a sketch that has different scenes sort of dropped throughout the episode. Arturo is trying to seduce this young white woman who, you know, wants to go out with her idea of a macho Latin man. And he's torn between just presenting himself the way he is or acting the way he knows she wants him to act. And every episode has multiple sketches in it that he's the center of. It almost reminds me kind of like a version of Key and Peele, but it's just one person, where sometimes the sketches will talk about race and culture, and sometimes the sketches are just being funny about something else. I think it's a really interesting show, and I hope people will check it out.
So that's Comedy Central's Alternatino with host Arturo Castro. Now I want you to end with something completely different. And yeah. This is FX's The Weekly, a documentary series by the New York Times. Here's a sample.
Families arriving at the border now faced a new directive. The numbers of separated children were growing. Parents would end up thousands of miles apart from their children with no way of communicating.
Tell us about the Times branching out, which it has a lot in recent years, and how you think it's doing with this documentary format.
Yeah, so basically this is sort of their version of 60 Minutes. I guess it's a news magazine. And they're often presenting stories that have already made a big splash in the New York Times. So it's solid reporting. It gives you a sense about how they reported some of these stories that you may have read in the New York Times before you watch the show. But I'm not quite sure if they've quite figured out the formula for presenting a new kind of news magazine that will engage new viewers beyond the people who already love, say, Dateline NBC or 60 Minutes.
Highly produced program as well. That's The Weekly. NPR TV critic Eric Dickens. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you.
This weekend, the casino giant Wynn Resorts will open its first U.S. casino outside of Las Vegas. It'll be in Everett, Massachusetts, near Boston. It'll be open 24/7, and WBUR's Callum Borchers says the state is already worried about gambling addiction.
Israel Rosario walks past slot machines at the MGM Springfield Casino. He's looking for players who've been there too long as part of a Massachusetts program to help treat and prevent gambling addictions. Rosario used to work as a craps dealer at Mohegan Sun. He says it was a fun job, but he worried about some of his regulars.
At the beginning, there were players that were happy, they were having fun, and then they just started, like, deteriorating over the years.
Rosario noticed some players kept coming back because they had lost so much money, they needed to win it back. He would sometimes talk to these players about their gambling habits.
Which would get me in trouble with the management because I'm not supposed to tell them, oh, no, take a break or you know, go have do something else because you're losing too much, you look depressed. This program didn't exist back then.
This program is called Game Sense. It was designed in Canada to help gamblers set budgets, understand their odds, and know when to stop. The program is run here by a nonprofit called the Massachusetts Council on Compulsive Gambling. Massachusetts state law requires casinos, including the new Encore Boston Harbor, to help pay for the program and let GameSense advisors like Rosario roam the gaming floor. Their job isn't to conduct on-the-spot therapy, but it can involve referring gamblers to other programs like Gamblers Anonymous.
I'm going to introduce myself the way I do in Gamblers Anonymous. Steve H., I'm a happy, grateful, lovable, recovering, compulsive gambler addict.
We've agreed not to use Steve's full name to protect his privacy. Steve worries that a new casino in Greater Boston could be an all-too-convenient enticement for people with the potential to develop addictions, which he knows can have devastating consequences.
I have a son. His name is Michael, and I've never met him because I was born when he was born when I was in prison. And the judge said, you would have bet him in a poker game, so I'm taking him away from you.
Steve says he was addicted to drugs before he got hooked on gambling. That's pretty common, says Mary Hafey, a former social worker who's helping train GameSense advisors to staff the Encore Casino.
The bulk of the training is around mental health issues. People who have difficulty with gambling and who potentially can develop a gambling addiction often have co-occurring disorders.
Researchers at the University of Massachusetts have found the vast majority of casino gamblers can play with no problem. About 2% gamble compulsively, their research shows, and another 8% have the potential to develop gambling addictions. Hafey says GameSense advisors can help those players cut themselves off.
We are there to support people with gambling issues through promoting a voluntary self-exclusion, which is when someone says, I don't want to be here.
In the past 3 months, 38 people voluntarily banned themselves from Massachusetts casinos, according to the Council on Compulsive Gambling. The council's executive director, Marlene Warner, says even people with no gambling compulsions can ask GameSense advisors for a little help.
Will you come tell me when 2 hours is up because there's no clocks in the casino, I'm not paying attention? Our GameSense advisor will go by and say, hey, Joe, 2 hours is up. What do you think? You want to leave now? So they're kind of there to meet them where they're at and provide the services they need.
For Here and Now, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
It's Here and Now. Anne Frank would have turned 90 this month. Frank is the Jewish girl who chronicled her experiences under Nazi rule in the 1940s. Frank's story is known because of the diary entries she wrote nearly a year before she perished in a concentration camp. She was 15 when she died. What is less known is how Anne Frank and the millions of people like her trying to escape the Nazis could have been saved, including by the United States, but weren't. For example, newsreels told of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's expression of outrage at what was happening.
President Roosevelt, in a statement without precedent, speaks out against the persecution of minorities in Germany. He says he could scarcely believe such things could occur.
But FDR and Washington failed to offer a lifeline to people like Anne Frank when they needed it. Dr. Raphael Medoff has written about this in an op-ed piece recently published in the History News Network. It's titled, What We Can't Forget as We Remember Anne Frank.
While the best known aspect of her experience is, of course, the diary that she wrote while she and her family were hiding in an attic in Amsterdam, hiding from the Nazis, there is an extraordinary additional story involving Anne Frank and her family trying to come to the United States before they went into hiding. And that's an aspect of Anne Frank's history that the American public is not widely acquainted with, but should be.
So tell us more about it then. Anne Frank's father, we should say, had relatives in the United States, in Massachusetts. He had hoped to be able to move the family here, but that never happened. Why not?
In 1933, when the Nazis rose to power in Germany, Otto Frank sent his wife and children to live in what then was the safety of neighboring Holland. They were German citizens living in Holland. During the 1930s, the United States had an immigration system based on national origin, meaning that a certain number of people from each country around the world could, in theory, come to the U.S. each year.
This is like a quota system, saying you can allow in this many from this particular region, but no more.
Yes. The annual quota for German citizens was about 26,000. When Otto Frank first took an interest in bringing his family to the United States, there was room in the quota because in 11 of the 12 years that Franklin Roosevelt was president, the quota from Germany was never filled.
Even though there was a huge demand, obviously, for people fleeing the Nazi regime and Hitler to come here.
Yes, the quota from Germany most years was less than 25% filled. So that means that 75% of the quota places simply expired. They couldn't be rolled over into the next year, so they were just thrown away. The Roosevelt administration set up a series of bureaucratic obstacles and extra requirements to make it as difficult as possible for Jewish refugees to qualify for visas to the United States. And as a result, all the unused quotas from Germany between 1933 to 1945, the year the Nazis were in power, during those 12 years of the Roosevelt presidency, about 190,000 quota places from Germany or later from German-occupied countries were left unused. So those are people who could have come to America, including the Frank family, within the existing quota laws, without changing or liberalizing the immigration system in any way, if the Roosevelt administration had simply allowed the existing system to be used up to the maximum number permitted by law.
So something happened in 1939. There were two members of Congress, a Democratic senator from New York, Robert Wagner, and a Republican from Massachusetts, Edith Norris Rogers. They introduced separate bills that would have done the same thing, and particularly with an eye on 20,000 German refugee children. Primarily, they would have been Jewish, perhaps some Christian as well. Tell us about that bill.
The idea behind the Wagner-Rogers bill was to counter the argument made by the anti-immigration forces that refugees would take away jobs from American citizens. So by focusing on children, the advocates were in effect saying, these young immigrants are not going to threaten anyone's job because they're going to be 10, 11, and 12 years old. Therefore, that should have made it possible to pass legislation like that. But in fact, the Wagner-Rogers bill ran into very strong opposition. President Roosevelt declined to support the bill, and ultimately the Wagner-Rogers bill was buried in a subcommittee, and those 20,000 German refugee children, would have been mostly Jewish, never came to America. But had the bill passed, then Anne Frank and her sister Margot could have qualified because they were German citizens and they were under 16 years old. So that was an opportunity to bring children over that never materialized.
There's something else that happened 80 years ago. The ship called the St. Louis, with almost 1,000 people on board fleeing Germany, tried to come to the United States, and it was turned away. What was the reason that they were not allowed to come ashore here?
The refugee ship, the St. Louis, first approached Cuba because most of the passengers had landing certificates to be admitted there. When Cuba turned them away, the ship sailed north to the coast of Florida, and it waited there for 3 days as the captain and the passengers sent desperate telegrams to the White House pleading with President Roosevelt to let them land. Now, it happens that that was the one time, this is the spring of 1939, when the quota from Germany was full. So they could not have come in under the regular quota. But it happened that just a few months earlier, the governor and the Legislative Assembly of the U.S. Virgin Islands had publicly offered to open their doors to Jewish refugees. This was right after the terrible pogrom in Germany known as Kristallnacht. And when the St. Louis was hovering off the coast of Florida, the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, proposed to President Roosevelt and Secretary of State Hull that permission be given to the ship to land these 930 refugees in the Virgin Islands so they could stay there until it might be safe for them to go back to Europe. Unfortunately, the president rejected that proposal, and the ship was forced to return to Europe.
And to what end did the people on board come?
What ultimately happened was during that two-week voyage, negotiations were undertaken by American Jewish organizations with several governments. England, France, Holland, and Belgium each agreed to take about one-fourth of the passengers. Those who went to England ultimately survived World War II and the Holocaust. But those who went to Belgium and Holland and France went to countries which very soon afterwards were invaded, occupied by the Germans, and many of them perished in the Holocaust.
President Roosevelt himself apparently did not say much about why he did not want to allow these refugees in. There are others who did speak, including his cousin, who was the wife of the U.S. Commissioner of Immigration at the time. What did she voice? Because I think the assumption is that many other people believe the same thing.
President Roosevelt's first cousin, Laura Delano Houdling, was the wife of the U.S. Commissioner of Immigration. She was at a dinner party in Washington in the spring of 1939, and she casually made a remark to the person sitting next to her about the Wagner-Rogers refugee bill. She was opposed to the bill because, in her words, 20,000 charming children would all too soon grow up into 20,000 ugly adults. We know she said that because the person to whom she made the remark was a State Department official who wrote it down in his diary, and historians found it many years later. The significance of the remark is that it kind of epitomizes the nature of the opposition to allowing in even Jewish children from Germany during those days.
And I think what puts a finer point on that sentiment is what happened in 1940 with the children who were allowed in.
Yes. The bitter irony is that just 1 year after those 20,000 German Jewish children were refused admission under the Wagner-Rogers bill, President Roosevelt rushed to Congress to approve a measure to bring in several thousand British children in order to rescue them from the German bombing of England. So Jewish children were turned away, but British children were admitted and their lives were saved.
When we look back at that time in history, there are not exact parallels to what's happening today, but what is the message that you draw?
It seems to me that the most important lesson to learn from America's response to the Holocaust is that we have a moral obligation to extend a helping hand when other people are being persecuted around the world and when we are able to help them in some way.
Dr. Rafael Medoff, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
We'll post Rafael Medoff's op-ed piece called What We Can't Forget as We Remember Anne Frank on our website. That's hereandnow.org.
In a series of tweets this morning, President Trump confirmed that he rescinded an order to carry out military strikes against Iran 10 minutes before they were supposed to occur. "We were cocked and loaded," he said in one of the tweets, to retaliate for Iran shooting down an American drone that Tehran said was over Iranian territory, a claim the Pentagon denied. The president said he rescinded the order when he asked how many people would be killed, and a general told him 150, and he decided that would not be proportionate to shooting down an unmanned American drone. Let's bring in Jim Walsh, here now security analyst. He's with the MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jeremy.
And you were not surprised by what happened. Why not?
Well, I sat in this chair a week ago talking to Lisa, and she asked me, does the president want to go to war? And I said, I don't think the president has a strategic bone in his body. There is no plan here. There are going to be days when he doesn't want to get involved in another war in the Middle East, as he has talked about often. There are going to be other days where he wants to strike back and strike at Iran. And so a week later, that happened, but it just played out over the course of several minutes rather than several days.
So do you think that it is quite possible that that strike would have gone through?
Well, I mean, if you authorize a strike, that's sort of a big deal. I mean, that's saying to the U.S. military that you can carry out an attack on a foreign country.
But the fact that there was no strike in the end means that there has been no U.S. response to the strike on the unmanned drone. So is that the way it will stay? And if that is the case, what does that mean for U.S. credibility there?
Yeah, well, I'd say two things. First of all, the president deserves some credit, and I didn't get a chance to talk about that. You know, proportionality is a very important concept, both in international law and in international security. And he appears to understand it and had an important role in his decision. So that's to the good. Your question about, where we go from here, I'm sure the Iranians are confused. Are we tough or are we soft? Mm-hmm. We seem to do both at the same time. And yes, it's good to keep people off balance, but not if that encouraged them to make mistakes, to make miscalculations. So I fear us sort of jumping around the board is going to make it easier for Iran to make a mistake. But I think we need to pull back, right? Let's set the context here. We've had tanker attacks. We've had drones shot down. We had tweets saying this is a big mistake, followed by tweets saying, no, you probably didn't do it on purpose. We've had actions authorized and then rescinded. And we're going to see more of this because the policies in place are the policy in place. The structure of the problem hasn't changed. Today, it's drones. Next week, Iran is going to blow through some of its limits on the nuclear deal. Mm-hmm.
The U.S. pulled out of last year.
Which the U.S. pulled out of, exactly. 2 weeks from then, on July 4th, they may announce that they're going to increase their levels of enrichment. We are locked in this fight with them right now. And if it's drones today, it's going to be something else tomorrow. And if we're not careful, one of these times, we will end up in a conflict, most likely an air attack on Iran, and that will have consequences even greater and worse, in my view, than the 2003 war with Iraq. So,
what do you think the Iranians would do, and what would they have done if the U.S. had actually carried through with this airstrike last night?
Well, again, assuming it was smallish, you know, the estimate being 150 people would be killed, my guess is they'd find a way to retaliate in somewhat a proportionate manner. You know, we have lots of assets in the Middle East.
In Iraq.
We have in Iraq, in Syria, elsewhere. They would be potential targets. There might be others as well. But they would be compelled, I think, by public opinion, if not their own inclination, to have to respond in some way.
Now, the underlying thing that's going on in the region here is that Iran and Saudi Arabia are big rivals, and Saudi Arabia is very close to members of the Trump administration, to President Trump, to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's also a senior advisor. How much credibility would the U.S. have in deciding to, you know, really go after Iran when the European allies look and see that dynamic playing out, too, and say, well, you're just doing what Saudi Arabia wants you to do?
Well, I definitely think the Europeans would be horrified if we had gotten into a war with Iran. They're fighting desperately, though not particularly effectively, to try to hold the Iran nuclear deal together. And they don't see another war in a region characterized by war as being helpful. I mean, the situation is deteriorating in Yemen right now. I have reports on the ground about that. Other things don't seem to be going well. And then to have, you know, the U.S. could carry out is powerful enough a player that it could say, you know, to hell with the Europeans and what everyone else thinks. We're going to do this because we're able to do it. And they could do it. But again, I think the consequences would be, if this escalated to the point where we attacked their nuclear facilities, I think the most likely outcome is that Iran would wake up the next day and say, okay, fine, then we'll build nuclear weapons. You know, they built 19,000 centrifuges. They know how to build a centrifuge.
Well, and do you think that a year from now they're going to have a nuclear weapon? The way things are going.
I hope not. It's always good. War is an unlikely phenomenon. It doesn't happen very often, thankfully. And so, there's a possibility that we will have a low-level conflict. Then the question is, will that low-level conflict rise to something that gives one side an opportunity, in this case the U.S. or Israel, to bomb nuclear facilities? If we reach that threshold, then we will be on the road to an Iranian nuclear weapon.
Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.